interested in joining this select group, please consider a donation of $1,000 or more online at wpfwfm.org. Your donation helps WPFW build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Welcome to The Collision.
The Collision, where sports and politics smash, Thursdays at 10 a.m. and on iTunes and Google Play. WPFW, Washington, D.C.
DC. We're listening to that song, None of Us Are Free Till All of Us Are Free, which is going to be our theme for this hour. And we're also doing a special second hour today at 11 o'clock, talking about the rallies, the two rallies that took place here in DC. So stay tuned with us till 12 noon and beyond. This first half of this show, I've been so excited about this for months, and we are happy and honored to have Denise Rolock Barnes, the publisher of The Washington Informer, who is celebrating the 60th anniversary of The Washington Informer throughout this year. We're going to be with Denise for the next half hour. Hopefully Chuck will be jumping on with us, but good morning, Denise.
Good morning. Good morning, Joni, and good morning, WPF family. glad to be with you all this gorgeous morning in Washington, D.C.
Yes, I don't know. Well, we have some sobering news, of course, that we're going to talk about in the second hour, what's going on in this world of ours. But for some of this first half hour, it's going to be a lot of joy. I know for me and for people who are familiar with Denise and the Washington Informer, amazing history. And I'm proud to share it, a part of it, because I'm learning that a lot of the younger people do not know the important history of the Washington Informer. So Denise, let's start out with congratulations with you, to you. Tell us when the Washington Informer, the date and year that the Washington Informer was launched.
It was launched on October 16, 1964.
And as some of people would know, October 16th is a very important day. It's not only the day that John Brown raided Harper's Ferry, it's also the date of the Million Man March.
Exactly.
And more. So the Washington Informer is in good company. So let's start with, of course, we're going to talk about some of the history of the Washington Informer, relationship to PFW, and your wonderful celebration last Friday. But we're going to start with your dad. Tell us about Calvin Rolock, who is still a hero to many of us. Tell us about him and what was going on when he launched the Washington Informer.
So thank you for that opportunity, Joni, and to talk about my father, Dr. Calvin William Rolock, came to Washington, D.C., I think it was in 1950. Mm. I'll just share with folks that we did a 60th anniversary publication which was inserted in the paper week before last. And if anybody's interested in getting a copy, which has the complete history of the Informer, a lot of great photos, great, a lot of great stories about our honorees, we certainly would love to share it with you. So, you know, just give us a call here at 202-561-4100, and we'll make sure that you can get a copy. But my dad, like so many of, I'll say our parents or grandparents, you know, came to Washington, D.C., was born in Texarkana, Texas, went to Prairie View A&M University, wanted to be a football player, got tackled on the field and decided he would become an announcer. And his brother played football, but he left Prairie View, majored in business administration. That's where he graduated and, you know, joined the Air Force. And he was, you know, participated in the Korean War. He was a paratrooper. He left the service, relocated here to Washington, D.C., following his older brother. And worked actually for at the Pentagon for a while. He sold insurance for one of the nation's only two or three Black-owned insurance companies, North Carolina Mutual Beneficial Insurance Company, which is where he met Marion Barry as a young kid in Memphis, Tennessee. And also became good friends with Benjamin Hooks, as you know, was an attorney, a preacher, former chairman of the Federal Communications Commission, and also president of the NAACP. So, you know, in that Memphis area, sort of where he sort of, you know, got his connections to the civil rights movement. Came to D.C., like I said, met my mom, Vera Abbott. They married, they had me. And not long after that, he, my mom, my stepmom, all were very, very engaged in the U Street Business and Professional Association, because, you know, D.C. was still very much segregated in the early 50s. And so that's where all the Black entrepreneurs were, which is why we have a Ben's Chili Bowl, Industrial Bank, and Lee's Florist, and so many other institutions that were operated along that corridor, including one of our former publications, the New Observer newspaper, which was located at 9th in Florida. So my father became the managing editor of the New Observer, and which is where I kind of got a chance to, you know, go to places like the Howard Theater as a little kid, and, you know, met Nat King Cole and Sarah Vaughan, and didn't know who these people were, but, you know, because I hung out with him, I got a chance to meet folks. And then later on, as the, you know, as things began to, Black folks began to, you know, stretch their muscles to, you know, to try to gain some type of leadership in the city. And then, you know, so there became a movement for self-determination. I don't know if they were looking for statehood at the time, but it definitely, you know, home rule was really key. I remember my father started the paper because he wanted to focus more on the political movement of the city and letting people know kind of what Black folks were doing or not being allowed to do as we were trying to gain power and influence in the District of Columbia. So at that time, Marion Barry had come to the city, Stokely Carmichael was here, Channing Phillips. I mean, there's a whole bunch of folks who were really involved in that movement, and women as well. And that's when he decided to start the Washington Informer. By that time, he had married my stepmother, attorney Wilhelmina Rolark, who was, like I said, she was a lawyer and very involved in that whole movement as well. And so, I mean, we can, there's more and more, but I will say that I remember one of the first newspapers, first editions of the Washington Informer, his headline was D.C. controlled by suburban white folks.
Wow.
You know? And he's then... He wrote his one and only book called Know Your DC Government, And wow. He did it on purpose because, and I have the copy nearby, but he wanted people to see, you know, who ran these agencies. He wanted people to see their faces. It was a picture book. It wasn't much text in it, but mostly photographs of all of the individuals who ran every DC government agency in the District of Columbia. And it was mostly, I don't think there were few, if any, Black faces or any non-white faces, I'll put it that way, mm-hmm. in that book. And that happened as a result of him trying to get a meeting with someone in one of these agencies. And he sat there for almost 3 hours because no one would, he had set the meeting up, but they kept delaying it. And he didn't know that this person had walked past him a couple of times and ignored him. So that's when he realized we need to know the faces of the people that run our agencies. And today we still do.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Race has very little to do with it. It's really about knowing who runs our government agencies and making sure that, you know, we stay in touch with them and keep them accountable for what our needs are.
Absolutely. Denise, I know I had really hoped you could be on for the hour, but you said a half an hour, so we have a lot to cover in the next 15 minutes. Share with her, because for those listeners who do not know, Calvin Rolock was and is a major hero. He was a hero right there with Marion Barry. So tell us also about the Black United Fund, if I'm getting, or is the United Black Fund, and, right. and your dad's role with that.
Well, you know, that the United Black Fund was born out of the out of a movement, again, of the Black United Front. And you had folks like Marion Barry, Ab Jordan. There are a bunch of, DC activists who recognized, as we all did, how do we channel our resources? There were organizations, nonprofit organizations that were doing work in the community, but they didn't necessarily know how to get their 501c3. They couldn't get their, you know, the tax exempts, the bylaws, all of that structural stuff was what was lacking. And I think there was a conversation. I don't know the whole history, but there's a conversation about creating a fund. And my father, you know, went forward, launched it with the help of my stepmother, who, you know, put all the groundwork together. And it was at a time when we had the combined federal campaign, and which was what we call United Way today. And mostly Black and brown organizations could not get support from the combined federal campaign. So they sued. United Black Fund sued them for racial discrimination, and they won the lawsuit. And the result of that lawsuit was that, you know, now, and this was the first in the country, that a percentage of non-designated dollars, undesignated donations to the combined federal campaign had to go to the United Black Fund. So you could designate an organization, but a lot of people just gave to UGF, CFC. And so those dollars, it was that pool of dollars that a percentage of that had to go to UBF. And then eventually the CFC became United Way, and United Way and United Black Fund had a great relationship. By the time my dad had passed, by the time he passed in 1994, United Black Fund started, I think, in 1974.
Hmm.
By 1994, there were over 100 small community-based nonprofit organizations that were getting grants from United Black Fund. In addition, you know, they helped them to do their bylaws, to set up their boards of directors, to make sure they had their 501c3 status, you know, help them with locations for rent. I mean, all kinds of training was provided for these small nonprofits to help them to grow. The amount of money they got in some cases was small, you know, but you think about institutions like Howard University Sickle Cell Center, that was one of their major programs, and actually was responsible for purchasing the sickle cell mobile that used to go around the city. So there are a lot of things UBF was credited for, and it saddens me that they're not where they were.
and they're not being, this history is not being remembered. I'm happy to see that Chuck has joined us, and hopefully Chuck can jump in with a question. But we have a lot to cover. I just want to say that from my perspective, and I'm sure many as well, that Calvin Rolock, again, was a hero. I would consider him a revolutionary, and he was very much linked with WPFW. So I'm just going to mention that for a moment. I remember back in the day when Calvin, I believe both Nap, Don't Forget the Blues Turner, which some people don't even remember Nap, who was on the air with us for decades, together with Gaston Neal, who was also on our airwaves, were working closely with Calvin Rolock, and including in the month of September, I believe they worked together around the substance abuse issues. But Calvin was right there, from my memory, with Tom Porter back in those early 90s on WPFW. Do you want to say anything?
That actually, Joni, because when I think about it, you know, when the Washington Informer was started, we were located at 715 G Street Northwest, right in Chinatown. Wow. The back of the building where the newspaper was located was the back of the building where WPFW was located, because WPFW was at 8th and H, and we were at G. And so, you know, Askia and a lot of the folks that were there, you know, you'd come out and just walk around the block and go into PFW. And I think that's really, and that had to have been maybe the late 70s, early 80s, I think, when that connection really began. And then you think about, I'm having brain freeze, but you know, Tiger Flower, folks that did Human Kindness Day. You know, their offices were right upstairs from our office. It was a lot of us in that little downtown block that connected and supported one another.
Absolutely. And so in my way of looking at things, Calvin Rolock was always a part of PFW from as long as I can remember. Chuck, you want to jump in with a question or comment?
Well, I'm reminded of how much Dr. Rolock had his pulse, his hand on the pulse of the people, and not necessarily the people who were upper middle class, but the people who were struggling, poor people. He was very, very aware of the challenges that poor people face, and how important it was for them to have a voice. I think that one of his greatest attributes was having the sense to understand that people who were poor, Black, and people of color were struggling and needed a voice, and he became part of that voice. We'll be forever grateful, as well as his daughter, who has that same philosophy. She needs not want to forget on whose shoulder I stand.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And Denise, so we only have 10 minutes left. Is that right?
let me check.
But because I'm going to keep rushing, because we also want to celebrate your dad and you and what the Washington Informer has been able to do and has done with all these decades. Neither Chuck or I were able to attend what I'm sure was a fabulous celebration the other Friday. But, and this may be hard to do, but if you could pick out for those people who don't know, and remember there are listeners who don't know, some of the highlights of the Washington Informer, either starting with your dad or starting with when you became the publisher. What are some of the things that you're really proud about and maybe were discussed at the celebration?
So the one thing I'll say about the celebration, Joni, tell this probably speaks to what I'm most proud of. You know, I just thought 60 years is, you know, it's a long time, but it's not a long time, right? And so it was hard for me to really think about what we could do to celebrate ourselves. And I looked around and I said, the stories that we tell are about our community. You know, Dr. Rollard, my dad wanted to make sure that, you know, as Black press across the country does, to make sure that, you know, we amplify the voices of our community and we give our community reasons not only to fight, but to celebrate for things. And those are the institutions that have also carried us through. So I looked around and I said, well, you know, I mean, they're the folks that we normally celebrate. Ben's Chili Bowl that just celebrated, I think, I forget how many years, but Industrial Bank just celebrated 70 years. Lee's Florists, about 70, 80 years. Cheryl Lofton, who has a tailoring shop, fifth generation. And we looked at even an institution that's not a Black-owned institution, but served the Black community and continues to do so, which is Chuck Levin's, which is now in its fourth generation. So I looked at generational businesses. And those of us who are in leadership of the institutions that our parents and grandparents, and in some cases, great-grandparents started, that still are serving this community, to me, that was what we need to celebrate. We need to acknowledge those businesses and those families who understood the mission of legacy and vision and you know, sort of enjoying our own culture or the culture of D.C. You know, we are D.C., right? A giant foods commercial because it's like, we are D.C. I'm like, whoever did that was like fantastic when they came. But we are D.C. So we really used the anniversary to celebrate them. And one of our honorees also was Stefan Lockridge. You know, Stefan's uncle was once the president of a member of the DC school board. His father was a member of the school board. They're Black men who have been in education. He has a legacy of education. And Stefan is a, you know, young man in his early 40s who's been teaching for 12 years. You know, and so there's a legacy of education there. So that those were our honorees. And we just happened to weave a little bit of our story into that. But, you know, our story is the Washington Former story is our story. It's Washington's story. It's the way we've been able to capture what people have done to make DC what it is. And now we can always be critical of things that, you know, happen or don't happen. And we write about those things. But in the end, we have so much to celebrate. And in our 60 years, we're celebrating with all of Washington. So that's, you know, I mean, if we talk about running a business, you know, we all had our ups and downs and what have you. But, you know, we're just looking at how we've been able to not only survive, but thrive during riots, you know, a whole bunch of stuff that's happened in the city, and even now what we're facing and how it's going to impact our businesses.
Right. And Katia just texted me saying she grew up, I think she said her dad used to take her to Chuck Levin's all the time. And I know a lot of other people I know have spent a lot of time there. But I wanted to also celebrate the present, the articles, the journalism that you do each and every week. And of course, Askia used to be a regular contributor. Julian Malvaud is now, and others that are part of the PFW family. But also the stories. And I must give a shout out to Sam P.K. Collins, one of your great reporters. And just this last week did a fabulous front page picture with Tyrone Parker, who is part of the PFW family, just came out with his book. And he's going to be celebrating that book at, I think, Ben's Chili Bowl, April 13th. But the way that the writing is, it's just outstanding, that story alone. So I think for people who do not know the Washington Former, you can find it on many, many places throughout the city. But we want to congratulate you, for Denise, for the outstanding journalism that you do each and every week.
Well, I am just, I'm a, I'm a graduate of Howard University's School of Communications. I lean on the school a lot to make sure that, we provide opportunities for their interns, trying to recreate that relationship with the University of the District of Columbia. Historically, and I'm proud of this, historically, the Black Press has been the place where people's those journalists have launched their careers. They started with us. And then some go on and become, great journalists in other places, and some will stick around. I'm just proud of the fact that the community has supported us, and local businesses have supported us to the extent that now we can pay a competitive wage. Because always that, you work for the Black Press, you're working for peanuts and there was a time that happened, but we really strive now to be more competitive. But we need to be competitive all across the board. And I'll just say this, Joni, when I remember a few years ago when I pulled all the publishers together to do a special issue for Black Press Week, because we're a member of the National Newspaper Publishers Association, and Black Press Week, we always celebrate here in Washington, D.C. And there were at least 14 Black-owned newspapers in the DMV. Today, there's one. And that saddens me. The Afro is still circulated here, but, they're Baltimore-based. It saddens me, but it means that there's more of a responsibility we have to make sure that our community's voices are heard. And so we, if I can say, we just like WPFW, if we ever needed your support, we need it now. And because we just, this is an era where people don't support journalism. They've stopped reading newspapers. They've stopped listening to radio stations. They've stopped watching television. And they're beginning to slowly turn off social media. But you need information. Kathy Hughes used to say it all the time. Information is power.
Mm-hmm.
And so, we need WPFW and The Informer and others. So, your sport is critical right now. So,
yes.
Yeah.
And I also want to give a shout out. People may not know that about 2 or 3 weeks ago at the Metropolitan Washington AME Church over there at 14th and when I'm getting...
Fifteenth and M,
the Church of Frederick Douglass, the church where Rosa Parks had her home going, and much, much more. There was a fabulous event celebrating 98 years of the Black Press and 60 years of the Washington Informer.
Actually, 198 years.
Oh. Sorry. 198 years, almost 200 years of the Black Press. And it was just a really inspiring event. Just talk briefly, I know we're almost out of time, but about Ben Chavis and the National Black Press and your relationship to them with The Informer.
So, I'll start off by saying, I know that for The Informer, I wanted to have, as we celebrated our 60th anniversary, I thought it was important for us to go to a house of prayer, because everything I believe as I get older, prayer is critical, right? I should have believed it earlier, but I really believe it now. And so I thought, we needed inspiration, and I wanted to do something with just with The Informer, but then recognizing, what's happening to journalists across the DMV, that maybe we should have a Black Press Sunday, no matter who you work for, no matter whether you were Black or not. If you were a member of the media, we needed a place where we could come and get a word of inspiration. So I reached out to Reverend Lamar, asked if we could do it at Metropolitan because of the historical significance that you just mentioned. And he, said, let's do it. And so fortunately, the National Newspaper Publishers Association, which is our president, Dr. Benjamin Chavis, was there as well to celebrate. And like I said, it was Black Press Week because the first Black newspaper in America was founded on March 16th, 1827. And so that was it was just coincidental that the 16th was also a Sunday. And so that's why we all gathered there. The National Newspaper Publishers Association is our trade association. And there are over 200 members of NNPA. They're Black newspaper publishers from around the country. And the interesting thing to me, Joni, is that I would say about 30% of those publishers are women.
Wow.
And I would say maybe about 20% of us are second generation publishers. So, you know, so that's why we, I mean, folks were in town, but they couldn't get to that. But it was so good to see other local journalists there. But yeah, the NNPA will be celebrating the 200th anniversary of the Black Press in 2027. And so it was, you know, it was a great gathering and a great message, I think.
Yeah, so
for us to get together and
it was truly inspiring. Chuck, you're listening to WPFW 89.3 FM. This is To Heal DC. We're proud to have Denise Rollart Barnes, the publisher of the Washington Informer, who are celebrating their 60th year throughout part of last year and this year till October 16th, 2025. And in a moment, we're going to jump to speaking with Ward 8 activist Mustafa Abdul Salam, who's going to share with us one of his projects. But Denise, I'm going to ask you for a few more minutes.
I'm good. Good job.
So again, we would have loved to have you on for the hour. So, and Chuck, if you have a question, you can jump in now. But I want to continue with the being proud of the Informer.
Just briefly, one of the things that I think about the Black Press is that if it had not been for the Black Press, the fight in the civil rights movement would probably have not been as successful as it is, because white press did not cover much of the civil rights movement until a Black Press started doing it and covered the Emmett Till and all the many other stories that happened. But white press did not cover the civil rights movement in the beginning. It was the Black Press, and for that we're grateful.
And you're right, Chuck. And the fact is, it's the same. It's true today. The stories that you read in the Washington Informer are not going to be read in the mainstream mostly white press. So we are very proud of the Informer. And I'll say one of my dreams. I hate to say I have a dream because we have to move beyond dreams. But I really think, and I haven't discussed this with officially yet, but I really would love to see a strong partnership between WPFW as we move forward into these very frightening, challenging times. WPFW, which is essentially a Black-run community radio station, really the only one that's Black-led, I believe, in the whole country, and a partnership with WPFW and with the Washington Informer. So even if it's not official or whatever it is, we hope to really be working more closely with you, Denise, as in these challenging times.
Well, I think, you know, that's, as I say, that's nothing but a word. You know, now we have to manifest it in some way. And I'm really grateful to WPFW, which is, been there when we did our Martin Luther King parade and peace walk. You know, you all have been there to support that. And, you know, we're looking for ways when you all do your anniversaries or different ways we can help to support. So it's a conversation that we need to have to figure out how, you know, what will work for us, but not only just for us, for our listeners and our readers, you know. Right. Because that's what we really want to do, is to try to amplify, I keep using the word amplify, but amplify these voices so that folks will know that there are alternatives out there that they don't have to turn off. They need to turn on. And so I look forward to having those conversations. I'll just say as an aside, you know, we're talking about doing the same thing with Howard University Television. You know, they're looking for ways to partner. If this moment in time hasn't done anything, it's at least expanded the conversation of how we need to work together more intentionally. And so I'm looking forward to those conversations. And if I got to pull that together, then that's what I'm going to do.
Great. And Denise will be telling you more offline, but PFW is celebrating our 48th anniversary on Friday, April 25th, with a fabulous event, beautiful concert. So perhaps you can join us on that occasion. But we'll definitely be in touch with you. We're thankful. As far as I'm concerned, I'd be happy to have you on all day. and Denise is often once a month on with Ambrose Eileen Jr. At 5 p.m. And his show To the East, Ambrose is recovering and is in the stage of recovery. We know that he will be back soon. We don't know exactly when, but he would have been on, Denise would have been on with him today, but we send Ambrose all of our love and get well wishes and look forward to Denise and Phil Pinnell with the Anacostia Coordinating Council being back on with Ambrose at 5 p.m. So Denise, I hate to say goodbye to you. But
yeah, well, I'm just down the street, kind of across the river and around the corner. But anytime, Joni, anytime.
Yes. Yeah, I'm gonna reach out to you, you know, later on today or definitely by tomorrow.
Right. That's the big things coming up. Emancipation. Yes. And you know, yes. Again, stories that people don't know that we need to help to tell so that every generation that grows up in the city or comes to the city knows about the story of the nation's capital.
Absolutely. We're not going to share it today, but we do have a special DC Emancipation event coming up, which we will be hopefully sharing soon. Denise, thank you so much. We're going to jump into Focus on Ward 8 in a minute, but congratulations on your 60 years, and we wish you many more, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you so much, Jimmy. And Chuck, take care.
Okay, we're going to have a little music, and then we're going to talk real quick to our next guest, Mustafa Abdul Salam. To welcome our next guest. He has a little less time than we had planned, but Mustafa Abdul Salam, we are thankful to finally have you on the airwaves with us. Good morning. If you can unmute yourself, and hopefully you will be right on. Mustafa is doing a very special initiative in Ward 8, which he's been working on for a number of years. I hope he can jump on and tell us about it.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yes. Good morning, Mustafa.
Good morning, and I'm glad to be on. So thank you for inviting me.
Okay, and I'm sorry we have a little less time, but first of all, Mustafa, tell our listeners who you are, a little bit about who you are, where you're from, and then we're going to jump into your work that you've been doing in Ward 8.
Again, Mustafa Abdul Salam. I'm a native of New Haven, Connecticut, but I've been in D.C. for over 20 years, and I came down to run a child welfare agency called For the Love of Children. Did that for a number of years, decided I wanted to stay in D.C., so I relocated to Ward 8. And at the time, Marion Barry was still alive in the office, and he was preparing for gentrification that was on the way. He created two entities, the Ward 8 Workforce Development Council and the Ward 8 Health Council. I got actively involved in the Workforce Development Council, and over 5 years, I participated and took leadership in creating three strategic plans. And after the Workforce Development Council kind of went away, I continued focusing on the need to come up with a plan for Ward 8. And over a number of years, got the seniors in Ward 8 to create a senior council around community development and use that as a platform for advocating for the plan. And in February 2023, the community created the plan. It's called the Ward 8 Community Economic Development Report. And in that report, we had 1,000 residents and had over 50 town hall meetings. And the report reflects the findings of the residents and of interest they have. So anybody that really wants to get a picture of what's going on in Ward 8 and what the want, if you read that, it gives a lot of clarity, which is important because in the past, there wasn't that kind of documentation. So therefore, it was much more difficult to really focus on the needs of the community. So that report really positions Ward 8 to really have a clear agenda that is a bottom-up agenda that represents the residents' needs and desires, as opposed to what happens traditionally with most things are done top-down, and those types of strategies, whatever comes out of it, really is not reflective of the community. So opportunity to with the report to build on it. And last year or so, we have been working to create what we call the Ward 8 Community Economic Development Think Tank. And the think tank is an opportunity to take the report and actually implement it and make sure those things that the residents identified can come into fruition. So we're excited about it. If you're interested in going into the website, it's ward8cedthinktank.com. So ward8cedthinktank is one word, and then .com. The website has just been created, but it's designed to help people understand what we have done over the last 5 or 6 years to create a report, and now are looking to implement that report. So we're excited. We actually have a documentary of the planning process coming out in September.
Wow.
An opportunity for the community to actually see what has accomplished. And there's no other ward in the district that has this kind of comprehensive report of what the community desires moving forward. So it's been a major achievement, but we're only starting. What we're trying to do with the think tank is move away from reacting to crisis and being more proactive and looking at ways that we can develop strategies for the next 5, 10, 20 years to really change the dynamics in the community. So that's just a brief overview.
And that's very exciting. We're very proud. I'll say, I'm sure many of our listeners are very proud of what you are doing. And I guess I have two quick questions. I know that you said you involved, did you say 1,000 residents? And I believe that those residents were a cross-section of young people, correct? And
yes,
older people. So just talk for a minute about the cross-section of the Ward 8 residents that you involved very actively in this report.
Yeah, and what makes it really important, special, is that the actual surveyors were residents. We identified residents, trained them, and they were the ones that went out and did the survey, which is different and exceptional because most times you have people who drop into the community that do the surveys and then they take the data and leave. We actually, everything that we've done around the report and creating the report was dealt with in the community itself. So it's again, an excellent model of what you can do when you invest with a with a bottom-up process. You actually engage the residents, you empower them, and because of that, they, you know, are much more interested in participating. So we had the whole range. We had residents as young as 14 and as old as in their 70s, male and females. And what we saw with the data that we collected is, yeah, that poverty is really the biggest challenge we have in Ward 8. And mainly because for the last 60 years, we have invested in poverty in ways that no other neighborhoods have. And we're seeing the outcome of that, where you have people who have been so dependent on systems that they now are struggling to become self-sufficient in an environment that no longer is taking care of people in need. So we see this as a critical turning point, but it's an opportunity for the community to begin to focus on wealth building as opposed to poverty, because wealth building really is the answer for a lot of the issues that the community is facing. If we can increase incomes levels through education and workforce development activities, then we have a greater potential of the current residents, most of the current residents, being able to stay in place as gentrification continues to evolve. One of the effects of gentrification is that the rents and the purchase of homes become so high that if you're not at a certain income level, you just can't afford to live in that environment. And we're moving very closely to that reality of Ward 8. So if we don't do anything significantly to increase residents' income and minimize the housing, you know, issues, then we're going to continue to see a lot of people being displaced, and we're going to see the population, particularly of the African-American population, decreasing.
Absolutely. And of course, the homelessness is rising. I just want to say again, we're speaking to Mustafa Abdul Salam. I'm going to say I'm very proud of you and the work you're doing. As someone who's worked for decades in the D.C. government, I started when Marion Barry was there, but ended up when he was long gone. And what Mustafa is saying is absolutely correct. When the government these days and perhaps other groups do these surveys, there's very little involvement with the community and very little, frankly, commitment to the community. So the work he's doing, I would say, is extremely important. What would you say, Mustafa, are, you know, as we know that poverty is a crisis in Ward 8 and really in this country, and of course, overcoming it would be is quite a challenge. How would you say would be some of your hopeful goals that might have been included in the report? Or where do you see you and your work moving in the next, let's just say, 2 to 5 years, given the fact of the crisis that the nation is in now, right now?
Yes, that's a good question. Again, we have to move from being reactionary and crisis oriented to more proactive and create entities that can be institutionalized. And that's one of the things we're trying to do with the think tank. We need entities that are not reactionary in nature, but do the hard work of collecting the data, developing those strategies that move the community forward. Again, if we're talking about 20 years, and the reason why 20 years is so important is that you look at a child born today.
Excuse me, I'm sorry, Mustafa, for a minute. I hear Chuck in the background. If you want to jump in and ask a question or else keep yourself on mute. But did you have a question, Chuck? If not, okay, I apologize, Mustafa.
So a 20-year plan allows us to look at the child that's born today. What do we need to do to make sure that when they're 20 years old, they're self-sufficient and can function and create the kind of life that is a healthy life? We can't wait till they get 5 years old or 10 years old, definitely not 15. So we're really focusing on developing our most precious commodity and asset, and that's our children. And the way we're looking at how we measure our success is on the growth and development of our children. So we want to be child-centered, family-focused, and community-based, which means that everything we do, we got to ask the question, how is it going to impact children? If it's not impacting children in a way that is positive and it's going to help them to be healthy, then the question is why we're doing this. And that has to be our measurement for everything we do, because children are our future. And if given the opportunity, they can develop the skills and the ability to transform not only their community, but their society. And that's how important and valuable they are. So we're, again, excited because we're trying to move in areas that we have not been before. We have not really taken a leadership in developing our own agendas and controlling the resources in the community. And that's a key point. We want to move to the point where the community is co-governing with the government. It's no longer a top from the government. These are the things you have to do. If you want funding from us, this is what you have to do. We want to be able to have our strategy and talk to the city government about what we can do to work based on trying to promote. Because governments don't have a long-term agenda because they can't. The most they can have is like as long as they can stay in office, 4 years, 8 years, even 12 years. But the community can have a 20-year agenda, 40-year agenda, and they could outlive any elected official because it's the community. So the power and the strategies need to be built in the community. Because if not, anytime the administration changes, the community has to change with that administration, whether it's a good or bad thing. And that's not good for the community. So institutionalizing the work of community economic development is very important. And community economic development is the key to turning communities around, particularly Black communities, because it focuses on things like livable wage jobs, affordable housing, the right education, and creating the infrastructure in the community so that it can manage itself.
Okay. We have about 2 or 3 minutes left. I want to make sure I ask you this question about the schools. I'm hearing a lot about what's happening these days in the public schools and how it may be impacting teachers and children. Do you have any comments on that, or if not, any other thing you'd like to say?
Education is a major institution. It's, again, we prepare our young people to grow in adulthood and be productive. So if the school system is not functioning correctly, is not working to make sure our children have developed, then the community is not going to go anywhere. In most neighborhoods, the schools are the major a physical entity in that neighborhood that has the ability to bring the neighborhood together and organize the neighborhood. So schools are very important, and we're looking to work with the Board of Ed to make sure that they integrate themselves into what we're trying to do as a community.
Right. And I know we have a wonderful young man who is on that Board of Ed. You probably work with him. I believe his name is Kalik Barnes. Mm-hmm. But we have just a minute left. I want you to repeat the website, but in very quickly tell us about your monthly gathering for mental health and children in Ward 8, I believe.
One of the things that came out of the report is the need to focus on mental health and trauma. So we put together a monthly open house, first of every Tuesday at the Art Center, where people could come. And the discussions are very good. It's very healthy. We talk about the impact of mental health on individuals and community and trauma, the role that trauma plays in creating problems. We also have a male support group for males ages 14 and up that we meet every third Wednesday of the month. And that's been very productive. So those things can be found on our website. Our website is ward8cedthinktank.com. ward8cedthinktank.com.
Mustafa Abdul Salam, we want to thank you very much for the work you're doing, and we hope to have you on in the future. I hate to rush like this, but we're just about out of time. Again, repeat the website one more time, Ward 8 CED.
Ward 8 CED, well, excuse me, it's WCED, W8CED Think Tank. It's W8CED Think Tank.
WHCED Think Tank. Okay. And that is Mustafa Abdul Salam doing very important work, I say, in the spirit of Marion Barry and many others. Keep up the wonderful work. And we are going to transition now. We're going to be continuing at 11 o'clock with a special hour focusing on the two rallies that took place on Saturday. So stay tuned. But we're going to go out with a song again that Ambrose Ali Lane Jr. Senior used to play, and I think it's very appropriate for the work that Mustafa Abdus-Salam is doing and all of us are doing. So let's hear it, Mikey. Thanks so much for Magic Mike. Thanks, Chuck. Thanks, Mari. And we'll see you in a few minutes.
We got to try to feel for each other. Let our brothers know that we care. Got to get the message. Send it out loud and clear. None of us are.
Hey, this is Alvin Nedab, your host of Music Memories, and my co-host,
Deborah Nedab.
And guess what, Deborah?
What?
We're moving.
We're moving?
That's right. We're moving from Mondays, 2 a.m. to 5 a.m., till Saturdays, 2 a.m. to 5 a.m., starting next Saturday, March 22nd. And Deborah, guess what?
What?
We're going to still continue to play the best old-school music of all time. So we just want you to be there, 89.3.
Greetings. WPFW is pleased to announce the relaunch of our major donor program, now known as the Jazz and Justice Circle. If you gave $1,000 last year or so far this year, you are automatically enrolled in this cherished group of listener members, and we thank you. Benefits of your membership are at WPFWFM.org under the Support Us tab at the top of the homepage is the Jazz and Justice Circle. Interested in joining this select group? Please consider a donation of $1,000 or more online at WPFWFM.org. Your donation helps WPFW build a better world one broadcast at a time.
Hello, I'm Dave Zirin, host of WPFW's The Collision, with an editorial. Mahmoud Khalil, a student at Columbia University and a U.S. permanent resident, has been illegally detained by ICE for organizing against the U.S.-supported genocide in Palestine. In detaining Khalil, the Trump administration, the State Department, and the Department of Homeland Security have made clear that they are more than willing to violate constitutionally protected rights to punish those who speak out against them and Israel's war on the people of Gaza. This is a deeply alarming development. It is a march towards authoritarianism. It is a blatant encroachment on our democracy, and it places all of us in peril, especially members of the most vulnerable and marginalized communities in our country. In the words of Angela Davis, if they come for me in the morning, they will come for you at night. Standing together as people of conscience and demanding Mahmoud Khalil's freedom, it is a stand against fascism, and it is a stand for our collective right to free speech and protest. I'm Dave Zirin. This has been a WPFW editorial.
Are you in the process of writing or updating your will, trust, or estate plan? We invite you to consider adding WPFW as a beneficiary through a charitable bequest. Bequests can take many forms and are usually the largest and most impactful gift a donor will ever make. Your bequest will help to ensure the programming WPFW has provided for almost 50 years will continue into the future. More info available by email at plannedgiving@wpfw.org or by phone at 202-588-0999, extension 344. Or you can let us know you've already included PFW in your plans through those same channels so we can add your name to our growing list of legacy listeners. We are listener supported. We are Jazz and Justice. And because of your support, we are WPFW.
Hi, this is Jim Byers, host of the Latin Flavor Classic Edition. For nearly 5 decades, support from listeners like you has kept WPFW's wheels rolling. In fact, the single largest category of donations comes from those who donate an unused car to the station. That's right.